This week's episode of the Warner Wound Podcast is brought to you by Bulova. Own a piece of musical history with Bulova's Frank Sinatra collection, featuring vintage-inspired watches. Stay tuned to a bit later in the episode to learn more.
Hello and welcome to the Worn and Wound Podcast. My name is Blake Bettner, and I am in studio today with a bunch of people right in front of me. This is great. No screens around. I've got Zach Weiss right there. Hey, Zach. How are you?
How's it going?
Good.
I'm good.
There's Patrick. Hi. Hey, Patrick.
Hey, guys.
Producing and contributing to this one. I like having you on, Patrick.
Thanks.
And we have, for the first time in person, Mr. Thomas Calara. Thomas, hello. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. Feels good to be in person and not in the computer.
Yes.
For once.
And you are on the East Coast now.
Yeah, that's right. Same time zone, finally.
Same time zone, yeah. Are you adjusted? Your body's all...
For the most part, yeah.
Okay, great. Well, it's great to have you here, and we've been doing some cool stuff with you here. We've got some cool stuff on the docket as well, so really excited to have you here. What are you wearing on your wrist?
Today, I still have the Doxa Sub 300, the Shark Hunter. Last time I was on the pod, this was the watch that I... was wearing, and I said that I was going to be wearing it all summer, and still staying true to that statement.
You've been wearing this all summer long.
I do, and I know this is a only audio format, but I have this gnarly watch tan, so so it's pretty bad, but that's what's on wrist.
It's a cool watch. I'm fond of that watch as well. I hope one thing that I wanted to see when they did that army. The case, they shaved like 1.2 millimeters off the thickness of the case. Not that the thickness is a huge deal, but it made
watch
a...
Watch out.
Yeah. But it was... Because that's such an unusually shaped case.
Yes.
And that's not even that thick of a watch.
No, it's not.
So I don't know where they took it out of, but it felt really great on the wrist. So, so hopefully we'll see that. Before we go any further, I want to give a shout out to Cat Shoulders, who did the podcast last week with you, Zach. Thank you for filling in. That was a great episode.
Yeah, it was fun.
So
felt like the old days. Yeah, sitting around recording over the internets.
Yeah. She is, of course, fabulous at this. Probably better than any of us. So I don't know why we're still on, but until they figure it out, we'll still be on. We'll have her back on next week, hopefully. Patrick, I feel like that's the watch you usually have on when we're doing this. What is this thing?
Purely coincidence. This. I think I was wearing this last time we did a podcast in house.
It's true. You do wear other watches.
I do. But if you only listen to the podcast, you wouldn't believe that. It's a Grand Seiko SBGR 017 from 2006. This is the white dial variant. There are four in total. But no, it's four standard, and there's a two
not four of
editions.
That watch.
No,
four colorways.
Yeah, and it's going up for auction later today. There are four. There's a quartz variation, and then there's obviously the mechanical, and there's a black quartz, and there's two limited editions. If I'm not mistaken, I think just two of this case, but it's a reference you don't see often. And I like the case, I like the bracelet, the movement 9S55. It's okay. They don't make it anymore. They've moved on.
Ask, so they don't make that movement anymore.
No, okay. I mean, the 9S series is still ongoing, to my understanding, right? I don't know. You know, they have the 9F, the
9S,
and then
9R. I think the letters have to do with the mechanical, the type of high bead, spring drive, etc.
Right. Yeah, I love it, though. I just think it's aesthetically gorgeous. My favorite Grand Seiko. The best Grand Seiko. Putting it out there.
Wow.
That's right. Jeez.
No, it's real nice. It's real nice. But no comment, but it's real nice. That's all I have to say.
Fair.
That's got quite a bracelet. It feels like it's got little cylinders on it that are bizarre. It's very, very different language from the current Grand Seiko.
Right. You know? Yeah. I don't know if these are structurally more secure than the average link because of how it's built. I have no idea.
They just articulate a little further. Yeah. I don't know.
They haven't loosened it at all over the years. They're still really tight. You can actually, there's little nuts there. You can tighten those and then it'll string
your bracelet. Yeah, it's all screw and the screws go into this weird cylinder.
Yeah.
That's a funky
bracelet. Yeah, I'm on record as This is a strange watch, I think, but I enjoy seeing it on your
your wrist.
On your wrist, yeah.
Yeah.
It makes me uncomfortable for some reason. Yeah, I don't know. But we'll have a link to an image of that down below. We should do a video with that thing or something with it.
It's a funky one.
It is a funky one, yeah. I'm wearing a Daytona. Not very interesting. Zach, though.
Wow.
Zach, I want to talk about...
What, is that a Paul Newman?
I don't think so.
No.
I don't think he...
No, I'm joking. No.
It's not Paul Newman's Paul Newman.
It's not a Paul... It's not a Paul
Newman. It's not a Paul Newman.
It's a modern...
It's a modern...
Some people like these watches, I've heard. So, you know, I mean, you can... Well, there's some fans of the Daytona out there.
Real fan, yeah.
You know.
True, yeah. Yeah, trade...
From
true,
before,
true
the, before the from, days from the of before hype, times. Pre-hype days,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. But the Paul, there is a modern dial version that people call a Newman.
Oh, really?
I don't see it at
like
all.
Like a Newman? Like,
only because it's a Newman.
Yeah.
Paul, more like Newman. It's, I think it's because it has three different colors on it. It's like, this like oh. Red and black and gold or something
I
like that.
I've seen there is a weird one. Like, I don't know the references, but there is one with like a red index that occasionally you'll see. And you're like, that is
with
strange.
Black, yeah. It is. I'm not overly fond of that. Of that execution in particular. I like this dial because it has the filled in sub dials. And the silver. I like the silver dial as well. But Zach, what are you wearing?
I'm wearing a watch that is in for review called the Horage Supersede.
Horage.
We were debating.
What did what did you call
Harage?
It?
Harage.
It is interesting without any context, like how watch names are pronounced, because like you've no. I mean, why not?
The internet will correct you.
The internet will correct you, but like you have no context for how this word is said. No.
The internet is always right.
I have heard. I years ago had dinner with some of the people behind this brand in Beale. And I don't recall exactly what they said, but I do think it was Harash. Not Harash.
Okay.
But yeah, this is an interesting, it's a very interesting watch. And read the article when it comes out, you know. But the star of the show is that it features their new movement in it, which is called the K2, which is a micro rotor movement. Designed and manufactured by Harash with their manufacturing partners, that is. Well, I mean, it's a micro rotor, which unto itself stands out, but it's a like 2.9 millimeters thick, 72 hour power reserve, chronometer grade like this one here is certified. And then this version has then a true GMT, a power reserve, and a 24 hour hand, making it, I think, 3.3 millimeters thick. There's like a module there, but the whole watch is still under 10 millimeters. And then this watch is priced at 6,500 Swiss francs. So in the Swiss micro rotor world, that is the, well, actually now there's that Hercules, but that was kind of a unexpected thing. But other than the Hercules, you have like the Slim d'Hermes, which is a Valcheer movement, and that's at a little over 7K.
Yeah.
So it's quite a value, you know, proposition, as they say. Mm-hmm. But this movement isn't just for Harage. They have sold it to other brands, and presumably in the next few years we'll start to see these out in the wild. So
it's an interesting movement, and I'm excited to see where it might end up. The proportions of the watch are really beautiful, especially considering the feature set that it has. It has a visible power display or a power reserve. It's got the AM or the 24 hour. There's a small 24 hour hand and then two 12 hour hands.
Yeah, so that's kind of unique, is that the true GMT here is not like what you'd find on a Rolex. It is not a 24 hour. That's confusing when you, so there's you know, on a true GMT you have the 24 hour hand that is like home time and then independently adjustable local hour hand, which usually goes back and forth in like forward and back in time in, that's not how you describe it, you can jump
and back
hours,
can you imagine that?
You know, either way. And then it's also generally used for the date and everything. Here the third hand on the dial is on a 12 hour circuit, because the 24 hand hour hand will indicate day night.
Yeah.
So what's neat is when you're home, let's say, you can actually hide that hand behind the hour hand and look like a 3 hour, like a three hand watch on the main dial. You travel and you can jump forward, only forward though, the other hand. That's where it gets a little awkward, and the use case kind of changes, because one of the nice things about a true GMT is, you know, you fly 3 hour difference, you change it, you're done. you fly back, you change it back, you're done. Here, you have to reset everything when you go back,
kind of. Yeah. Okay.
It didn't seem to skip the date forward, though. So you
well,
could,
it
you
will
technically...
skip the... It is, when you go all the way around 24 hours jumping, it will change the date. And if you rotate the other way, it changes the date rather than going backwards. Okay. So that's the difference.
Take it back.
But it's still function rich, quite unique.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and great proportion. That watch is quite peculiar, I find. It's aesthetically, it's quite striking.
It's an integrated bracelet, 39.5 millimeters. You know what's funny? That whole integrated steel bracelet thing was, you know, so they unveiled this like 2021. Is in the our article is from September 2021 when they first announced it. And I feel like the integrated bracelet thing was really like,
it is,
here it is, everyone's making it. I feel like that's already maybe passed a bit.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, it certainly like had a moment that it was like, this is like everybody's got to jump on that train, and everybody did.
But logically, it takes a little while to develop a watch. Right. So
exactly,
they're going to still come.
So
out.
I think you'll see a lot of big brands. I think in the next like year and a half or so, you'll see more trickle out, and then they'll hopefully just be judged based on like, well, is it good or not? Rather than, ooh, it's an integrated. Yeah. It won't have. It won't get to live just on the hype factor. It will have to actually be good, which is fine. That's how all things. Theoretically, it should be. And this the bracelet feels nice.
Very nice. And it's not like an integrated. Like you would see this and be like, oh, it's trying to look like an AP or anything like that. Like it doesn't have that styling at all. It's got a rotating bezel on it. It's got much harder kind of facets to it. It's also 904L.
904L, there you go.
Look at that.
Yeah, really. It's,
yeah, there's no 24-hour markings. It's not the dual tone bezel. It's like there's nothing on there that like kind of screams, "Oh, I'm this kind of a watch" or anything. Like it's very much its own thing, and I think it's quite visually distinctive. For better or worse, I'm not overly fond of that texture that's on the bezel itself, that kind of grenade texture, as well as the like the logo is kind of like a dot pattern or something, but it's like there's a few of these that I've seen in person just kind of scarcely, but they like they immediately stand out as like, oh, that's
that
Mirage
brand.
Like
they have a funky design sensibility, certainly. Some of their previous watches had like shaped crystals and things like that, which is always odd. And I reviewed one years ago, I think it's called the Autark, which was sort of in this integrated sort of language. That one felt a little bit like had some 222 cues to it, but not on the dial or anything, just on the case. But yeah, no, it's an interesting watch. It wears beautifully. That is like definitely my favorite thing about it. I mean, it's a thin 39.5 millimeter watch that just with like, you know, essentially no lugs, that just drapes over the wrist. So
yeah,
can I see the insert on that? It looks like Bakelite, the way they've accomplished that.
That's all metal. It's all metal. There's just blasted metal and polished metal.
Oh wow, from a distance, yeah.
I have
like an insert.
I have an issue with hot take. I have an issue with sports watches / dive watches in particular having polished surfaces, maybe a bezel or maybe a bevel, but like polished sides. This is one of my things with like the Tudor Black Bay 58 and the Pro. I just wish it was brushed on the sides. I love the watch otherwise. I wish it was brushed on the side. So I was talking to somebody recently and they were saying that, you know, with the increase in shark activity, you don't really want twinkly things. They look like fish scales.
Yeah, that's exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Do they advertise this as a sports watch, the Mirage?
It's a 200 meter multi-purpose sports watch. You might end up in it's all terrain. Highest mountain, deepest, not deepest, but a pretty, you know.
But there are some polished surfaces on there.
Yeah, twinkle, twinkle.
Wow. They actually, you know, I'm pretty like hesitant about like wearing the Doxa out during surf sessions, because I mean, just take a look at this thing. It's got like the polished bezel.
Look at that
like
rice.
It
looks
delicious. It's a chunk of metal like on your wrist. And exactly like
ironic
you said,
that
like,
it's called the Shark Hunter when truly.
Exactly. When you're the one who's
shark
hunted.
Jumps on you.
Right. Yeah. How ironic.
The chum doesn't have the same ring shot.
Right. But I've heard that. But but I believe the Ranger is fully brushed.
The Ranger is fully brushed. Right.
Yeah.
Which was something that I personally really, really, I really liked about it.
Imagine
ironically,
that.
That's not their
wall.
Dive watch.
Right.
If that wall.
It wouldn't look as appealing to me.
Really?
If that was brushed.
You need the polish.
This guy with his blingy.
I need the
But no, I feel like if that was just a wall of horizontally brushed steel, it wouldn't be as appealing to me.
Interesting. Hmm. Yeah, I don't know how I feel. I generally like the original Speedy Tuesday had an entirely brushed case.
All of it was.
And it's one of those things you don't quite, and you're like, there's something different about that. And then you realize,
And I honestly didn't like that.
You don't like that one?
On that one. But no, because the Speedmaster, though, is such a different thing with the curve logs. Okay. Like, I just remember seeing it and just be like, yeah, when it occurred to me, like, that's what I was seeing. It was, Omega had some event and they had just like all, like a ton of watches there. And they had the Speedy Tuesday there. It was the first time I'd seen it. And yeah, it was just sort of like, it took away a little bit from the curviness of that case.
That's such an interesting case and intricate, and it's got beautiful lines and shapes and from a lot of different
water
angles.
Resistance of a Speedmaster. I mean, can't, no,
yeah, I mean, you can't swim in it, obviously. No.
Don't mess with sharks. Yeah. Aliens don't.
Sharks stay below 50.
Aliens ain't shiny objects.
On the moon, you're fine.
So I actually did quite a bit of swimming in the ocean with this very watch.
Wow.
Last week, I was in the Outer Banks of North Carolina. Little did I know. It didn't even cross my mind, because I'm never thinking about that kind of stuff. But now I'm like, ooh,
lucky
maybe.
Yeah.
One thing that I did, there was also a pool where we're at. And I was, Liam is like kind of working on his swimming stuff. So I threw this into the bottom, like the bottom, so he could go down and get it.
Mm.
And,
wow.
You know, work on controlling his body and all that kind of stuff.
Putting that 200 meter water is a test there.
And it's,
6 feet.
Yeah.
There's no sharks
in the
pool.
Look at the side of the case wall. Look at what it did.
I was going to say. This thing is.
Wait, from like just being in the.
Yeah.
Because I guess pools are always textured, right?
Yeah. So I took it off and just kind of tossed it in the deep end and, the, you know, whatever.
Hey, man.
But
how many times you toss it in?
That, I mean, that's such a distinct little scar. I mean, and it's a story, right?
It's
that's
a story.
That's a good one. And a lesson. Yeah. A story and a lesson.
It's mine now.
Yeah. So. No, I was I was walking through Prospect Park the other day on my way to work, and like I've been stopping to take photos of my watches and things, especially because I've been playing around with my new camera. And I put down a watch on like a rough surface, and I picked up. I was like.
Oh, no.
And I just realized I like dragged it a little as I picked it up, and it was fine. But I was like, "I'm such an idiot. What am I doing? Well, this is not worth the photo for Instagram."
It just looks like you were just trying to brush this yourself, man. Like you're just really trying to like find ways to like make this side of the case brushed.
It looks like individual sand pellets, made of.
Just like the idea of you throwing your watch as part of a task.
Right.
Bee blaster like, with a BB gun.
Yeah.
I've done it with my sub before for the same thing. But
was the sub fun?
So, well, the sub has got all kinds.
It's a different grade of steel, right?
It's a 904.
It's not. And it doesn't have. It doesn't have that
swimming pool safe,
right?
904.
You could drop this in a pool.
Right into the swimming pool.
The moral of the story is: do things with your watches. So throw it in the pool and have your son retrieve them.
Find out later.
Thomas, you spend a lot of time on beaches and in the oceans and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
What are we missing when we talk about like water activity, diving watches, all that kind of stuff?
You know, I guess it's just more so the accessibility of it all. I mean, you know, New York, we have water here, right?
Beaches here.
Yeah, right. The Pacific.
Rockaway, people surf out there.
Right, yeah.
No, Coney Island.
And they actually do.
Beach.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's just more so the fact that the weather is just nice. So it's just more so like, oh, okay. Yeah. And it's all year round. You know, and the beach is like 15 minutes away and it's not packed, you know, on a good day, like when it's like a really nice day, I'm sure that everybody here in this area, this is still a watch podcast right now. We're talking about beach. This is not a beach podcast, you know,
so. Like when you're
in the context of, you know,
what do you, when you go there, like we talk about dive watches and stuff a lot, but
you know,
never worn a single dive watch.
How often do you have to tell time when you're underwater
or surfing
apparently I get a lot of flack for wearing a watch out there, but then it's like then there's like guys out there that are like, hey, like what time is it, you know, so it does serve a function.
And then you're
there.
Like you should have wore a watch, bro.
Exactly.
What, like who gives you crap about wearing
you
did that article. Did someone
article.
Was like, who does a watch?
Yeah, I did an article on with the Seiko SME573.
Right.
And you know, someone's like, who goes out there
but
and serves
a reader
watch?
Or a
it was like a comment.
A comment somewhere.
Yeah. Okay.
But I feel like the people in California, you could take like your lunch break and go out and like surf and stuff.
Yeah,
so I feel like it's more relevant out there than it is like
yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right. And it's like, it's like practical. Like, you know, you got to know like how long you're out there. And then, you know, like you said, you have either you're on your lunch break or you need to go to work and you're doing dawn patrol and, you know, you need to get ready and yeah. But, it's definitely a different scene, you know, getting used to, you know, like when I moved out west, I said that I traded the New York skyline. I used to live right across the Hudson River in New Jersey. So I traded the New York skyline for the Pacific skyline, but now I'm back, but you know, still gonna try to, you know, use these watches, get them wet, get them in the water.
Yeah, there's plenty of stuff to do around here.
Maybe just dip my hand
in the water. I see, little jet skiers out on the East River all the time. Where do they get those things, and what are they doing in there? When we were on Governor's Island the other day, they were circling all around there.
Right.
I don't know if it's recommended to swim or do anything like that.
Don't go in the water, but
right.
Just stay above it.
Right. Just don't go in the water.
You know, breathe while you're getting the mist of the water.
I'm sure, isn't there like some sort of like vibration, like implication with like wearing your watch and jet skiing?
I think about
like,
that often.
Is that like a thing? Like, you know,
well,
I don't know.
Because you commute
on
an electric bike.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. And you wear a watch.
Yeah.
Or did you stop wearing a watch?
I stopped
on your commute.
I stopped wearing vintage watches.
A vintage watch
on my commute. But like a modern watch, I feel like they're sensible enough when they design these. They should make them. I know there's some amount of shock absorption. Like what kind of micro jitters or where can this actually handle? I do think about that often. I try not to let that steer what I wear though. Like I biked in with this Grand Seiko and it's probably the most expensive piece I own. So I don't know. I don't want it to deter me from wearing things I like wearing, specifically watch-wise in this instance. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's already from when I sent it for servicing, keeping bad time. So like, how much worse can it get? It probably only fix it. But yeah, I do think about that because I have a 7-speed and there's no shocks on it. So in New York roads aren't really that great, depending on where you're biking.
So I've heard.
Yeah. That's very true.
It's a pretty rocky ride. But it is an interesting question, though.
Right.
Not that I want to put this watch through that test.
Right.
I like that. I like talking about real world use cases for some of these watches.
I think there is some like the shock thing is interesting. I remember my dad, who is, you know, obviously older. Makes sense. He's my dad. he grew up in a time where watches were, you know, more potentially sensitive and had less like overbuilt shock protection. But that said, something like a 2824 hasn't really changed since the 70s, particularly like the shock absorption, unless a brand has gone above
still
and beyond
like
to do something.
Still like that Inkablock thing that's capped on the stone above the balance staff.
But it's really the regulation that gets messed up on these. And I think quick regulators like are more susceptible to shocks. So you have brands like Mueller Glass Schutte that have their woodpecker regulator, I think is what they call it, and it's like a regulator that screws down, so it kind of like freezes when it's in.
Yeah.
But like he won't clap with a watch on.
He's conscious of what he's doing.
I mean, I remember him telling you that. But then there's like, you know, famously like golf, I guess, like sends a real shock
that
up the hand
and
can screw up a watch.
I could see that. You're a steel rod and you're hitting a ball.
Yeah, yeah, and you
or
probably
clipping
don't,
the
you
ground,
know,
right. Depending on how your how, skill level,
exactly how good you are,
right? Right, that's gonna hurt your watch. It's funny though, because I remember hearing that, like, you know, people with their vintage watches trying to take care of them, and like their pattern around like going to see a show, and like they won't applaud loudly or they won't applaud at all when they're out. And I was thinking that was the silliest thing, but then I wound up collecting vintage and I'm looking at my, you know, like a 6139, and I'm like, actually, I went out of my way to buy I went out of my way to buy a 6138 UFO, a 5-sport variation, because they didn't apply lume to it. So I could clap when I was wearing it. Or I wasn't concerned about the lume breaking over time.
Breaking off.
But I specifically bought that vintage watch because I didn't want to think about broken lume, because that bothered me.
This week's episode of the Worn and Wound podcast is brought to you by Bulova. Celebrating their long relationship with Old Blue Eyes, Bulova pays tribute with the new Frank Sinatra collection. The range incorporates retro styles and unmistakable branding elements and includes 5 sub-collections named after beloved songs. The Summer Wind line features sport dress automatic timepieces inspired by the 1960s Bulova Date King, powered by an 8215 Miyota automatic 3H calendar movement with a 42-hour power reserve. Each Frank Sinatra piece is presented and special edition packaging inspired by a vinyl album box set complete with lyrics and vintage imagery. To learn more about the new Bulova Frank Sinatra collection, head to bulova.com.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I did. Well, I became what I feared most.
Yeah. Shock is interesting.
Yeah. The basic technology, though, hasn't really.
Since, like, Breguet, you know, it's the same thing. Yeah.
I guess so. Yeah.
Parachute, I think it's called.
Like those little. Yeah. I know what you mean with ankle block. I remember seeing ads for. You see the stuff on eBay for sale, like old adverts for like the shock systems they put over the jewels. Yeah. Like, I don't know how much that technology is advanced or evolved.
And even if you look at like brand new Rolex movements, it's the same, have it's a different shape and the KIF observer or something KIF like that. But like, it's still the same concept that's just kind of over there to.
What was the last.
But that's just the staff, right? That's just like, it's a certain thing, but it's not all.
It doesn't all, because if it gets off of its frequency, that's what will upset the accuracy of it. And so those regulators, high frequency movements come back into that accuracy faster.
When do you think they stopped putting Inca block on the dial of watches? Because I remember back in the day, you'd see the jewel cool count though, right? And Inca block on the dial as a selling point, right? Yeah. But we stopped doing that, clearly. But when was that? What was the last watch to say Inca block? As a selling
question.
Point.
That's a good question.
I wonder if it had to do with sort of just the, what do you call it? Like the condensing of the industry. Like ETA, essentially, I think, or it's there for Swatch Group, probably owns Inca Block. Whereas before, it was probably a product or its own, because it was once a cottage industry and all these things were. Yeah. So it's like, we have the best shock absorber, the Inca Block, and now that's.
Or you just write on the dial, shock absorb.
Yeah.
Or something generic like that. Yeah. That's interesting. Well, that brings up a topic that I wanted to touch on. I think three of the four watches that we're wearing have in-house movements in them, or what you would call, quote, unquote, in-house movements. Sorry, bro.
That's totally mine. I think you're probably going to see, like, my opinion on this is going to fall in line with the watch that I'm wearing and the fact that it doesn't have an in-house movement.
Is it ADA? Is it ADA?
Yeah,
they use 2824s in those Doxas. Still, yeah. So. Cool. A watch was released recently, which caused a bit of discussion about this, which I feel like comes up every now and again, of in-house or not, or I feel like there's a certain perception of when that term is used that you think of, like, there's a couple of watchmakers like building every piece of the movement in this one manufacturer, and that's what's going into these watches. And the reality is far, far murkier than that. And the manufacturers and suppliers for a lot of even the largest brands are, well spread out, right? And there's very, 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 very few watches where every single component of a movement or watch is just made in like the same
to be considered in-house
place to be considered in-house
right. Well, there's like I feel like there's always issues when the definition is extremely rigid, which seems to be at times the prevailing sort of understanding of it. Like, in-house means vertical integration, one brand makes everything, kind of a thing, which doesn't reflect the reality of
and even the brands that we might think of as being that are probably relying on other suppliers for other parts of
the
watches.
The most complex parts like hairsprings and...
Yeah, especially stuff like that. Yeah. So something that we thought we could talk about a little bit and just kind of get our thoughts out there on it. And not so much in the terms of like, we got to nail this down so we know, because it's really important that we have like in-house and so we can call it like... How often do you guys even think about that? And does it affect your purchase decisions? Does it affect how you think about their watches? Does it affect like the prestige level of brands that you perceive or anything? Like if they say in-house, I feel like 10 years ago, this wasn't really as big a thing. You know, it wasn't a big deal to use an eBausch off the shelf type situation. And you're getting a kind of a known entity that like has a solid track record that, I don't know, like there's less unknowns with it. And I feel like a lot of brands started to kind of spring up and maybe do their own thing and call it in-house in whatever form that took for them, so they could say in-house, because it's like now a very marketable term that you can put on something.
Right.
Like, this is in-house.
Like
or you see, it's a manufacturer movement.
Yeah, manufacturer
movement. Right, that's another thing. And you brought up the term in-group, which I think makes a lot of sense and might reduce some of the... ambiguity around this.
Yeah.
I feel like this is kind of an ambiguous thing.
I feel like it's just a simpler way that it reflects the reality of things. And, you know, the term in-house having like an implied prestige is sort of the nonsense of this all, because like a high-end brand can make a crap movement and maybe not know it for 10 years also, even if it's fancy, and they can make it all in-house.
But it's in-house.
So just, I mean, I'd rather just think of it as like the reality, like, are they literally manufacturing, like, you know, the way I use in-house generally doesn't actually mean that. It's more, you know, like a one that has come up recently was like Tudor's in-house, and that's sort of this good example of the kind of murkiness, because movements are made by Kinesi, but
they founded Kinesi in like 2015 or something like that. And then they had partnered with Breitling, like right at the gates, on that chronograph. And now Chanel owns a stake.
Chanel and also Norcane gets moved.
They don't own a stake, but they're using them. Yeah.
They're supplying their movement. So they started like a movement manufacturer
that is like another
sister brand, I imagine. It must be under the Hans Wilsdorf roof. Like, I haven't looked this up. But just logically, if it's part of them, you know.
Yeah.
But it's a separate company. So they're essentially getting movements that are made by a brand and then using them. There's ownership. You know, so just like, is that their house or is that them using?
And it gets to a point of like, you know, who cares? You know, like, what is this?
Yeah.
And even if you look at the terminology, if you go to Tudor's website, it says, you know, manufacturer caliber, MT50, whatever. And if you go to Norcane's website, it says the same thing, manufacturer, and then whatever term they put to it. So they're both kind of like using the same nomenclature to talk about this kind of stuff. So then it all comes down to like this perceived thing. So, you know, when we see a lot of people kind of complaining about, I think Val Fleurier was the manufacturer who Richemont Groups use, you know, then it kind of opened up this, well, it's not really in-house because it's other. And then it, you know, that's a big ball of yarn to kind of get into, because then like if you get into the ETA Swatch thing and every group kind of has their thing that they're using and different suppliers, some of whom help multiple different brands. Like, it gets into murky territory very fast.
Yeah. Right. So Myrato's in group.
Yeah.
Or the ETA. It's
exactly.
You could say it's in-house, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, like exactly.
Well,
like,
where do you draw that line?
I'm like, why not call Hamilton's movement an in-house movement? It's made by ETA. They're part of the same company.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
But then I feel like just saying in-group, because that is shared by X, Y, Z brands.
Yeah.
I mean, they don't make it any easier because each brand that uses like the 80-hour reserve movements, like they have slightly different numerals in the way they, like, it's the Hamilton H whatever or the
but there's
the
an 80 in there.
C, there's the 80 in the T cell, you know. So it gets a little confusing, but it's like different decorations on the same base. Sometimes they have temporary exclusivity on some of them, but eventually the whole kind of team has it. I feel like in group though describes the Val Fleurier. The Tudor one's a little bit stranger because it's like there aren't other ones in the group. They're really just starting to supply to outsource.
Yeah, exactly.
But they have their other companies with shared financial interest in that.
Yeah.
So like, even though Tudor and Chanel are completely and utterly separate in every way, like there's no relationship between the companies, they're both using something that they haven't vested in.
Yeah.
That's a little confusing.
And F.B. Bjorn has a stake in Chanel or something like that.
Really?
So,
wow.
I hope that wasn't confidential.
Huh?
Oh. But yeah, you wouldn't hear them saying blurring those lines, I guess.
Yeah,
I don't
know.
Like it really comes down to like what I feel like the angle that people are arguing from is kind of, well, like I want to feel like my watch has this value to me because of this reason, you know? Like,
what matters to me is more like, obviously, that there's a level of quality from any watch you get.
Yeah,
so like, period, you know. And I would rather, if like with Richemont, you know, if it's Val Fleurier and Val Fleurier is where they invest all their money on these movements and they are going to do hundreds of thousands of hours of testing on that base movement that then is going to end up my watch, like, that sounds frankly a little bit better than the, okay, we rushed to get a movement out so that we could truly call it in-house.
Yeah.
But like, ultimately what matters to me is like, it's more variety at this point. So like, that tends to be what draws me to some in-house movement, like a, you know, a spring drive or something, which is distinctly Grand Seiko. It's like, I can't get that from somebody else. Or, you know, like the sorry, the specs on the Black Bay Pro being, you know, a 70-hour power reserve, silicon hairspring, true GMT chronometer, free sprung balance, yada, yada, yada. That feels very distinct to what Tudor makes, even if it's a similar movement to what other brands have now. Theirs is the only with the silicon hairspring currently.
Yeah.
There just might be a patent thing there. But, and that makes that more interesting to me than other GMT. I don't know.
And I completely agree. And there has to be like a reason other than just, well, we just want to say that it's in-house. Like, well,
yeah,
what, like, right. Do you want a differentiated like feature set, and why, and what benefit is that going to provide the, you know, the end user?
Right, are there like any additional innovations, like what separates it from just a regular movement that could have like just been in that watch?
And yeah, like you said, the power reserve,
silicon hairspring, that type of thing.
And then I think for consumers, like my main concern is like, are you getting what you pay for? And I know for a lot of people, the complaint is, you know, why would I buy this luxury watch if they're not using an in-house movement at the same price as, say, brand X over here? It could be Grand Seiko, where I can expect to get a spring drive for $7,000 or whatever, right? You feel like there's a more perceived value there. And I don't know why that is. It's almost like mirroring the idea of a Swiss made and like the percentage of the components that need to be Swiss and where it's manufactured. Like, I know that for a very long time was a talking point for people. And it is a mark of quality. It's just what you're saying. You have an expectation.
I will say, like, because I also do get it a little bit, like, with the price concern where, you know, and there was something I think I said in A Week in Watches when about the IWC was that the, like, $4,500 Mark 18 versus the like $5,250 or whatever the base price is for the new 20 with this Val Fleurier 120-hour movement feels like a better value than the Sellita version.
Yeah.
Because even if it's substantially more expensive percentage-wise, like that same kind of Sellita base, you'll see down to $5,600. Maybe that's very low. Maybe let's call it $1,000 is sort of... and at a chronometer, like you can get a Sellita chronometer from Christopher Ward, you know, for a very affordable price. Right, so like to me, like once again, if I'm going to pay for that, like, and now I have an option for like this in-house or in-group 5-day, that just to me makes more sense, even if it's more money.
Yeah. I get that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then the other level I think about this on is in-house versus out-house is serviceability. Yeah. I think practically speaking, and I'm very practically minded, I want to make sure what I'm getting isn't some like very obscure movement where, you know, parts years down the road are going to be hard to come by, or, you know, maybe there aren't enough people that are trained to work on the movement properly. And that's actually a concern I have with vintage pieces too, with unique movements. But I think about that when it comes to my modern watches. Like, I like the fact that my Rado Captain Cook has a very common ETA. It just means to me that there are going to be more people ready and able to service it down the line.
You can take it anywhere in the world and be able to service.
Yeah. So it's a 2892, I think is what it is in there, with a 70-hour power reserve. I think they modified it to some extent. I know they have their own sort of naming convention for it, but it's that. Mm-hmm. But no, that to me is very appealing. So it doesn't really, I don't really look at in-house as a good thing. I know that seems odd to say, but for me, it usually means that it's going to be of an elevated price point, and then it might not be as serviceable, or, you know, maybe I'll have to hand it off to the brand itself and it could take months before I see it again. Which is something that I don't necessarily like.
Yeah.
Well, it's
very
reasonable.
The key thing is that that term should not be just equated with better or good. Like, it doesn't automatically 100%. Mean that it's good. I would say it's probably very hard to make a movement as good as a 2824 or a 2, you know, whatever. Like, those that have decades of, like, you know, track record on them. And even the movement in this, it had some teething issues, I would say, in the Black Bay GMT with the date issue and those are things that you know, probably normal things that just kind of work through, and they find these weaknesses once it's manufactured, like en masse, that's hard to find in testing with a few of them. And, you know, here we are, I don't know, however many years later, and like, okay, it's worked through that, and now it's kind of like getting to a really solid state here. But I mean, I've definitely seen on forums people talking about this as in, why would I take a risk on that when, you know, when they had this issue with the date, and that was 2018 or something like that, you know? But I think that track record and that, like, that means a lot to yeah. to people, even right. though, you know, you can't get a more like solid, reputable like brand than like Tudor Roll. Like, of course they're going to serve their make it right. Yeah. But it's still like, it's still there.
Yeah.
Know? So, but I, you know, I think it really does come down to like, why, like, what are you getting for it? Is it just for the sake of being in house? Or what have they done that differentiates it? But you know, the fact of the matter is there are a lot of people or a lot of manufacturers, a lot of suppliers that are collaborating in ways that you might not realize behind the scenes to get some of these movements and parts of movements and components, especially sensitive ones like hairsprings. You know, it's a smaller world than you might realize at that level, you know. So, and sure. I mean, even I don't know if you remember, Patek, Rolex, Swatch all collaborated on like the early days of the silicon hairspring too.
Yeah, that's, the, that's where.
And
the
then they all branched
is.
Off yeah. and like did their own thing. But I say stuff like that, like might maybe not to that scale, but happens more often than you think. And it might be for something as simple as like a certain screw that's a certain size that has to be done to a certain precision. And there's like one or two manufacturers that do it to that level yeah. that are supplying for, or like the base plate of a movement that needs to be this, you know, whatever it is.
Not to go off the rails here, but that's part of what always drove me kind of crazy about the like US made thing in like the ruling from X amount of years ago that US made had to be 100% made in the US when you have like so many specialized components within a watch, from the hairspring, which is like an obvious one, but you have, you know, rubies, you have certain screws, yeah. you have all these things that like have taken brands, companies, hundreds of years, some of them, or but at least decades yeah. to perfect their technique of, and that might be the thing they do.
Yeah.
To then say, no, you got to do it all in Wisconsin now.
Yeah.
And just like, well, like without like a huge amount of investment to force the research and manufacture everything ground up, which would take some like, yeah. you know, an Elon Musk type individual suddenly yeah. get into watches. Like, it's just never going to happen. So like a certain portion of reasonable, it just 100% just makes no sense to me. Cause like, why would you, if you want to make a good watch, why would you then want to bother with also having to deal with having to make right. every single tiny component, the oils, you
but
know,
like where does that end though? Like you, they yeah. could like, you could get money and then like hire the people in Switzerland and like bring them over and do that. So does it like, well, do you like check the birth certificates of people to make sure they're born in the USA to make sure that
it's
actual
exactly.
US?
It's nuts. It's like,
who cares about this? Like it's
so
the people
like
at the end
up,
of the day.
You know, Neuchâtel in some, you know,
in Wisconsin.
Yeah. In Wisconsin. Obviously. It's a great place to start. Why not? And like, you know, yeah. Bring everyone over who have the specialties. Because that's the other thing, you got to train people. So they are yeah. going to come from Switzerland, most likely, in Germany.
The, it's
and
the people, not the country.
Yeah,
more than
and then you got them in the... It's just, I don't know. It always irked me because I feel like it just really shot America in the foot in terms of getting yeah. to this high mark where you have like amazing, you know, brands out there doing all this other stuff, but they can't get there. Yeah. They just never will unless it changes. You know?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So
venting over, sorry.
has it ever affected a purchase decision of yours?
You know what? To be honest, like again, I'm just fairly new to the watch world and this hobby in general. And my initial approach to like purchasing a watch is kind of like, is it aesthetically pleasing?
Why not?
You know,
that's still my approach.
Right? Yeah. Right. Exactly. Right. But like, as I continue to kind of like learn and understand and, you know, appreciate like kind of what makes a watch actually tick. Yeah. Like I think it does to a certain extent, affect like what I would purchase. And again, going back to like, if a movement is in house and it does offer like X, Y, and Z, that's like makes it significantly better than a generic movement that was in the watch on a previous mm-hmm. model, then yeah. No. But I guess it's really like subjective because what's the price gap, you know, like, I guess like, mm-hmm. you know, what's the example with like Tudor, right? Cause like before they were using, like an ETA, right?
Yeah.
And then they shifted over to an in-house movement. And was that for the GMT, right? Was that the North Flag, the first one, but then
they started integrating them into the Pelagos and the 41 millimeter right. Black Bay. Yeah.
For, yeah,
but the first. Prices.
Yeah, I was gonna want. I don't know if
no
you.
No delta.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah, they may have gone up like $100 or $200, which was probably the most impressive. But they, which is interesting because they clearly priced them originally knowing everything they were gonna do, and you know that I think that was a really bold move for them that probably took people by surprise because generally speaking, you know, there's that increase like you know, Oris is a good example. Mm-hmm. They have their 5-day movement, and those are. Maybe
considerably
more
expensive,
but then still, you know, for what they are, though, you know, 5-day, quote unquote, in house, whatever that means, watches that are, you know, in the $3,000 to $5,000 range. So they're also still a relative value, but like it is a little tough when you're looking at one array of watches to be like, there's $1,000 jump between very similar things. But
ironically, those early ETA Black Bays are like. Somewhat collectible now.
Yep, they are.
Like the rose on the dial instead of the shield.
Smiling. Also the 2-line Pelagos, which was 2 millimeters thinner as well.
I can see that being popular by virtue of that.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. Those were nice watches, but Blake Mellon had one. I hope he regrets selling it.
We'll have to give him some shit about that.
Yeah.
What about you, Patrick?
What, so far as...
like, has it ever influenced the purchase decision of yours?
You just talking about those roses made me think of like those vintage Tudor Big Roses. I really wanted one. Sorry. yeah, I wish they'd bring that back. But not necessarily, no. I've been eyeing some of Oris's watches recently. I like the pointer date we sell quite a bit. I like that sort of sapphire blue dial. And it's mildly appealing that it's their own in-house movement, or I don't really know the story behind their movement.
Yeah, no, it's an in-house movement. I just, you know, like these other ones. I don't know if they're making hairsprings in-house or if they've contracted it. That's I just said, that's such a huge thing to undertaking to do that it doesn't probably make sense for them to have invested in making their own hairsprings.
Yeah, I feel like my purchase decisions are almost solely led, having collected watches for going on 11 years now. I would say it's solely led by the look of the watch, honestly, the appearance and the feel of it on my wrist more than anything. I actually think back to when I was a kid, I had a Burger King watch I wish I had still. When Jurassic Park came out, I forget which one it was, but they had a series of digital watches that I really loved, and I had one that was a raptor's eye and it was holographic, so it was the eye, and if you tilted it then you'd see the time digital display.
I do recall that.
You remember
that? I do recall that.
Like, but to me, like, I think of that fondly, and I don't care what movement's in there, like that was really fun, and like to me as a kid that was the coolest thing. And
if I met like an 8-year old kid who was like, I don't touch like anything that's not I'd be like,
no, I went to McDonald's. Burger King didn't make this movement, come on. Unacceptable.
You mean a hamburger? Hamburger better be back there. All right, that's McDonald's.
You're like, let me meet your parents. I need to talk to you. Yeah. What's wrong with you?
I'd love to see a watch snob 8-year-old. That'd be amazing.
Because if it isn't about that, you have to justify it through, well, it's an in-house. Like, and that's why I spent. Other than like, well, I like it. I like the way it looks. No. And it's in-house, you know, whatever you want to call it.
I feel like kids' meals to get in-house movement. It's a little bit more. That's interesting. I can't. I'm looking at a handful of watches now, and I'm actually looking for function at this point. I like the you sort of got me on to looking through some of Omega's catalog for their time zone function, which is basically just a jumping hour. That's what they call it.
So this is, I was telling Patrick, this is the most mind-blowing thing that nobody talks about. And I really hope I'm just not straight up wrong about, because it would be embarrassing. So caveat, asterisk to what I'm about to say. I might just be wrong. But that the Caliber 89, like XX movements from Omega, which is their newer range of movements, master coaxials, I believe all of them, have, quote, time zone function.
Yeah.
Local jump hour.
The globe... Master Time or whatever.
No, even just the Aquaterras. The Speedmaster 57 that came out.
Oh,
time zone function. So, when you're in the first setting, you can just jump the local hours.
Oh, yeah.
That's huge.
Brilliant. I think that's brilliant. It kind of eliminates the need for like a GMT or proper GMT.
Ming does
totally.
This too.
Ming did that on theirs. But
A
whole, the new Seamaster 300s, the new Aquaterras, that manual wound watch, which is where I first saw it. So Thomas Hall, who's been on the podcast, he put up on Instagram him changing the just jump hour on that manual wound silver dial watch, and it was just what?
So I guess to piggyback on that, it wouldn't matter to me whether that was in-house or not. It's just nice that Omega thinks of that and is placing it in a lot of their models. So the Globemaster constellation is kind of on my mind. I've only seen one in person. And I found it very attractive.
And I won't lie, with that, like you know, the BlackBerry Pro, part of why I got it is because I didn't have a local jump hour GMT, but to me that is part of a GMT. I don't need the fourth hand. I really just wanted the GMT, the jumping local hour. Yeah, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no.
Like,
no.
It's convenient.
Yeah,
so you know? Interesting. Yeah, it makes total sense. That's why I want one of these, because I like a three-hander. I'd even take it with two hands if the hour jumped.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
Like the Ming.
That's the Ming.
Like the Ming.
And it's you also cool. mentioned on, it was on a Speedy, or it is.
So
on
the Speedmaster. Yeah. Once again, I have to like confirm this in hand, but the Speedmaster 57s, the ones that came out last year, like the 40.5mm straight log ones, are a Cal 8.9, and it does say on Omega's website time zone function.
Yeah. Interesting.
That's wild. Like,
yeah.
So I'll buy other watch would you need at that
if it,
point?
No, you know? If it means that.
Exactly.
Yeah. If you get like a jump hour Speedy, like
that'd be kind of dope, right? Yeah.
But that is that. There's done. No like, like that.
Right.
Doxa, when you change the date, like you can go and just directly adjust the date wheel.
Right.
On these, should that is probably, the quick date.
Yeah, you got it. But you can just probably less quick. Change it backwards, which. Yeah. Is neat. You can't do that on the Arash, unfortunately, which is something I like just because occasionally you screw up when you're setting the tape.
Yeah.
It's silly. No. But yeah, no, that's a cool you know, that's one of the things like with also in-house that I feel like maybe you don't see quite as much now, especially because brands seem to get like longer power reserves are sort of better and is it people, you know, a brand would go through the trouble making in-house movement to clone a 2824 mm-hmm. or something. And just like, that I don't get at all because
just so they can say it.
Just so they can say it, exactly. And like, you know, or not clone it, but if like maybe identical in function. It's just like if you're not gonna make something that has some feature that at least is improved or like once again, you're not gonna compete then with the decades of trial and error that is in 2024. So you know, a local jump hour is a cool thing. Extended power reserve, if you're into that, you know, I don't know, other interesting things, one that comes to mind, the Nomos Neomatic. Mm. Like, that had some interesting, like, things with the date so that you couldn't, like, screw up the date function. Like, they built it into a more modern standard,
What do you mean, like, between the hours of, like, what is it?
Yeah,
like
I forget exactly what it was. It's just they took that stuff into consideration when they're building it, so, like...
I like that.
And it's super thin automatic. That's another thing. Make it thin, you know, like, or whatever. I don't know.
Because the whole thing, I think, is just built onto the periphery of the movement.
Dave, I think that's a patent of theirs.
It's a side note.
Date.
I've always been fearful of that, though. I know that at midnight, like...
Fears seems to have a lot to do with
it. But like, it sort of to jump back on something you were previously saying, like sometimes you mess up how you set your date. I'm curious as to how you guys set your watch when you're putting it on after it's been in your box or whatever for a while. Do you set it to the date? Like today's the 4th, I would set it to the 3rd, and then I would go past midnight, and then I would go to the time. Do you guys set it?
That's how I do it.
Is that how you
do
it?
That's exactly how
I do it. And then I'll always set the hour hand so that it is somewhere in the region of 6, so I don't mess up the date.
This is why I really enjoy having a 24-hour sub-dial, like, which is not that common, and most of the time you're like, what's the point of this? It's that. It's that. So when you pull it out of your box and your watch is dead, you know if it's like...
Is it close to
midnight, or is it, you know?
Yeah.
Right. Because I usually just like, screw it, let's see what happens. Right. I haven't broken a watch yet.
You know? But what is the fear? That the date wheel will be misaligned or something if you adjust it when you're not within those that certain magical window?
It's like
between
dividing by zero or something. I don't know. You don't want to find out.
Right.
I hack it so the seconds hand is dead at 12. And then I set it to whatever time it is because I feel like I'm usually setting the time like... at 9 a.m, 8 a.m, or something like this. So I bring it there and then push it in and then manage the date from there.
You don't go past 12 ever?
To check.
Sometimes I'm like, well, I gotta know because I also drive me crazy.
During the day when you see the date shifting, you're like, son of a.
I'll take the watch off and hide it for a few hours.
Like, you manually bring it around to see the date change.
I've done that so many times. You're like,
But I don't know if that's good because you're like manually going through it. Unless is it that you're not supposed to start it between the hours of like 9 and 2? Like, so if you start it at six and then go all the way through. Is that okay?
Yeah.
I need to get to the bottom of this.
Hey, watchmakers. Someone needs to teach us watching experts how to set up how to set their watches.
Yeah. If you know the answer, let us know down below. And
please don't stop listening and reading.
Nothing happens.
It's also let us know how you set your watch. What is the appropriate way to set a watch? Would you use just a local hour? What's not just an hour jumping hand? Without the GMT hand in 24, without a second hand.
With the local jumping hour hand, you also don't worry about this.
Yeah.
Right? Because of... That might not make any sense.
Well, you still
don't want to be in the middle of the change. Like, if the date is half off, which you can see clearly, like, don't screw with the
because
watch.
Because the date changes on that local hour.
Yeah.
Not on the home, on the GMT hand. So, I don't know if the same rules apply there.
I think maybe a good way to do it is like you pick the watch you want to wear tomorrow, the day before, and get it going. So it's like, so then by the morning, you'll kind of know where it is. Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah. So put it on your other wrist.
Yeah. Anyway.
Just to get it going.
So yeah, people freak out about the like power reserve on a Grand Seiko dial, and then they put it on the back of some of the movements, and it's a celebration. That's great. Let's put an AM PM indicator on the back of every movement.
Yeah.
True.
I could take that. Yeah.
Patek has it's just a little aperture that's either like dark or light, and it just it's a window that flips.
Who does
that's
that?
It's just an AM PM indication.
I feel like there's been some Seiko Brights models, or am I making this up, that have that indicator, or maybe Nomos does this as well. There's like, I know what you mean, the aperture that's just two-tone.
It's the same thing that's on that. It's just a disc with the half white, half black, and it's in a
little
hole.
On dial side, that's on that like travel watch, right?
Yeah.
The
5164 has it. Yeah.
But don't ruin my precious dial. Put it on the case back, please. You know.
Well,
all complications on the case back.
All complications on the case back.
The Daniel Roth Tourbillon, which was like from the 90s or whatever, absolutely gorgeous watch. Now they're worth hundreds of thousands of dollars, but it's got like an hour and minute dial, obviously, like the main dial, but it's off center, and then the Tourbillon at six. But if you flip it over, there's a very large pointer date on the back of the watch and power reserve. It's just absolutely gorgeous.
What you're describing is the perfect candidate for the Reverso, where you have all the complications in the back, and if you want the time, you flip it.
I think they might have, some models that are sort of mix like, and match things like that.
That are two-faced.
The duo face. I mean, those are some of the most underrated watches.
Right, for sure.
On another day.
You can't, like, if somebody asks you the date... Taking off your watch and then like flipping it over.
You're like tough. You're like, I can't access that right now.
Ask me the time.
I can kind of tell you the time. Yeah. I don't. Well,
kind of.
Yeah.
I mean, you gotta just watch out now, because like, if you just wanted, you know, I think we're giving ideas for people who are like stealing watches. Like, hey, what's the date on that watch? And just let me just hand it over to you.
So you put the date on the front most of the time, unless, you know, you're a Daniel Roth Tourbillon, but let's be honest.
Exactly.
If you see somebody with a Daniel Roth Tourbillon, easy mark to steal his watch. Just ask for the date.
We'll take it off.
Boink. And that guy wouldn't give you the time of day. Let's be honest. If he's wearing a Daniel Roth Tourbillon, he would want
the date. Wouldn't give you the time of day.
Wear
that watch outside anyway.
Yeah, that's a perfect note to wrap on, I think.
Recommendations without Rob.
Exactly.
Here at Worn and Wound. Thanks to your favorite watch.
If you listen this long, thank you for sticking around. We appreciate you. Let us know your thoughts on in-house setting watches and the value of an in-house movement. Let us know your thoughts down below, and we will catch you next week. Thanks for listening. Take care.